And welcome back to the Surely Unsure podcast with me, Veda. Just wanted to say hey and give a quick update. These are now going to be published bi-weekly, so every other week versus every week. Been doing some other things such as hosting a diversity in lighting roundtable. Please catch the latest episode at protestparty.tv. You know, as a lighting designer, as a BIPOC lighting designer, as a female lighting designer, I've had a lot of different experiences, of course, good and bad. And I just wanted to gather a few other BIPOC LDs to talk about those experiences, to find a way to make our industry better now that we have all of this time. So yeah, just check it out, listen to our experiences, reach out if you want to. The latest episode can be found at protestparty.tv. Awesome. So this next episode was recorded a few months ago, May 22nd, to be exact, with my dear friend and colleague, Anthony Dufka Fraschelli. So enjoy. Had a gig nightmare this last week, which was weird. So,
oh god.
So I talked about that. Yeah.
It's weird how like nightmares right now and just dreaming in general are such a like present thing, I feel like, in everybody. Like everybody is sleeping so weird and coming up with these really odd visions. And like, I'm not the type of artist that wants to like do a piece about like the current thing that's going on in the world, but like when it comes to dreams, I kind of do, because like I've had some fascinating things going on in internally that I would be interested in that I know no one else would. So but like that makes me wonder, what do other people have going on in their heads? And like that's what's interesting to me. Yeah,
it's been kind of fascinating to see how we're all like linked to each other right now in a really strange way.
Yeah, it's true. Like, I don't know if you ever read that article that was kind of like going around the theater circle last year about like how everybody that's in a theater when they're seeing something like basically syncs up with their heart rate by the end of the performance.
Whoa.
And it's interesting because like basically right now the world is our only theater. It's our only experience that we're like all like having together. And I think that's cool that like one of the things that is resonating throughout is like this dream world and like how fucked up it is.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. I don't think I saw that article, but that's wild.
Yeah, it was. It was some kind of study that they were doing. I think it was a dance performance, but I'd have to go back and look. It would require me to actually pay like a lot of attention when I read the Times every morning.
That's funny.
I wish like I actually had the paper edition, so I didn't have a screen in front of me. But like, I get distracted so easily, like in everything, that like it's hard for me to get through the entire thing when it's a screen and there's like also all these other news apps I have to check.
Yeah.
So like and like I want to like check everything, right? Like I read about an article and then I'm like, well, what's the source? And then I go to the source and then I go down a rabbit hole. So it's like I stayed in grad school and I'm just keep doing like bibliographies for everything.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, it's good that you're like chasing down the source and not just reading it blindly like me. Because I just read things and I'm like, oh, whoa, that's crazy. And I
I mean, I'm definitely doing that too. I definitely just like clicked on a link that was like, hey, cannabis might like solve everything, but only really strong cannabis. And in like, I read this whole article that was like basically saying if you have like 80% CBD, like some specific strain, it actually blocks the inhibitors of the virus and it won't latch on to you. And like, yeah.
Yo,
I
what
was
if
ex I was
that's the
ex
cure of it all?
Right? I was really excited.
Let's smoke out
Yeah.
the whole world.
Yeah. Basically, I mean, it said it was like a low THC thing and high CBD. Yeah.
Interesting. That's a little like essential oilsy, though. You know what I mean?
It is a little bit, but it wasn't like a complete like bullshit article. Like there was a study.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
Cool.
that's how you know it's real, right?
Yeah.
There's a study.
Studies, or the claim to have been a study.
No, I totally did my own study in San Francisco this past fall on CBD, and like it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, it like just calms you down.
Yeah, it's great. It's I did one. I experimented with CBD too, for a little bit, and it took my anxiety from like top level to just like almost nothing. And it was noticeable because the people around me were like, you seem like different today. Like, you seem like you actually got some rest. And I was like, totally.
Yeah.
But it was great because I still was sharp and I was still able to make decisions and like talk about things and do things like a normal human being.
Yeah, no, I mean like so they have
That's what I
gummies.
took. I took a gummy.
And like I went to this place like a dispensary, my first one ever, and I like walk in and there's like an appointment book and a waiting bar and it was like super high mod. And then like somebody's like, "Oh, Mr. Porcelli, we're ready for you." And I go up to this thing and it's like I'm buying a Rolex, but like he pulls out a menu and like there's a display case and it's all lit well, and it was lit well. And like basically like shows me this menu and I was like, "Yeah, I'm just looking for something to like, you know, temper the anxiety a little bit." Like, and he was gave me like a 3% CBD gummy that was basically like, this is next to a placebo. You should just take this and you'll be good.
Wow,
So,
yeah. That's awesome.
yeah.
So, how you been?
I've been good. I mean, yeah. How's anybody been? I've been good.
I hate the I've been sending, and I'm sure all of us have also been receiving a lot of the like, I hope you're well or as well as you can be during all of this texts, and it's hard because it is a, like I am sincere with it, like I do hope that everyone is well, but it's also
Yeah.
just like everyone is in a constant state of anxiety and boredom and just yeah.
It's true, like, and it's funny about that collection of texts that you just mentioned, because I get them all at once when I walk to the beach, because I don't actually have cell service where I'm at. So unless it's like coming from an iPhone, like I'm not actually getting like a lot of people's texts that I know. And then I go to the beach and I'll get like 30 texts that are like, "So hey, how are you? I haven't heard from you in a month." And it's like, well, I was out of cell range. But like, yeah, I'm good. I'm adjusting to the fact that I went from like 14-hour days at New York City Ballet, living in East Village, to living out on the coast in Oregon and doing like absolutely nothing in like 4-hour days. So, yeah, it's been in it like even without like a pandemic happening, it's been an adjustment. Because I'm just so used to like go, 3 cups of coffee a day and like focusing a million lights and taking notes and like assisting on all these different pieces and being inundated with so much art and culture. And now it's like the thing that I wished for the most, which was like honestly a break, has happened. yeah. But it's cool, like, I guess, in the sense that I am having time to reflect on the past few years of like academia and coming out of that and, training in the professional world.
Yeah, it's crazy because a lot of people, and I'm included in this, I'm really thankful for this time. And it sounds, I don't like to say that as well because there are people that are dying and it is incredibly morbid and it is really heartbreaking when we all think about it, but it's also it's an adjustment period, right? Of like everyone's life has just stopped and we're all just kind of at a really weird turning point. And I'm the same way. Like I love going and going and going, and now that I'm forced to stop, I'm being forced to like actually think about things and do things that maybe I wouldn't or don't want to.
No, I hear everything you're saying. It's been strange, like navigating to like I am like operating from a complete place of privilege now, where I am like so far removed from like the center of the city, where like where I like live in East Village was like really bad there. And like it's obviously much worse in other cities and places around the country. And like I don't know, it's just, and now I'm in the middle of nowhere and there's like 30 cases in Lee County. So like it's definitely been something where it's like constantly trying to like recognize like who and what I am in the world right now, which is wild to think about.
But you were also leaving New York at the same time, though, right? Like around the same time anyway.
So like basically like I had been working in New York for 5 months or so, like since the end of fall, somewhere in there near Thanksgiving, and working at New York City Ballet, Alvin Ailey Dance Theater, and some other gigs around the city. And basically after that was done, was planning on kind of traveling for a bit, because that was like a job that took me from my first year out of grad school to like a year later.
He's being incredibly humble. Anthony was the recipient of the Hensley Award, and it's a really amazing internship opportunity, and it grants people, usually of the graduate MFA level, to travel the world and work at some really amazing places, as he's mentioned, and get some really great experience and introductions to some really great places.
It's true. It was an incredible opportunity that somehow I was a part of, and worked at San Francisco Opera for half a year, and then, like I said, went to New York City Ballet and Alvin Ailey Dance Theater. Worked with an incredible collection of designers and colleagues that I learned so much from. I think my first month at the opera specifically, I learned more in a month than I did in 3 years of grad school. It was like definitely a remarkable experience that I'm so grateful to have had. And like that's the like super like politically correct answer. And the real answer is that it was really hard, and it was a really great experience. I had met some people that I hope to call mentors and friends for the rest of my life. And it was really hard. It was long days and really, really terrific. I wrote down everything, and then I realized I can't read my own handwriting. So,
Gotta write in all
yeah.
caps.
Right?
All
Right? You
caps.
do have to write in all
Gotta write
caps.
in all caps. Thank you, SRT.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but you were like, it just, you're so humble about your experiences, and so we need to gas you up a little bit there, you know?
Oh yeah, I'll work on that self-branding thing. Yeah, eventually. It's a weird industry to be confident in, for me. I'm speaking. Like
Same.
it's And like, I feel like I met people that are some of the most successful people in our industry working in this field. And even they, like working for like 50 years, some of them,
That's
like
crazy.
even they seem to have like the imposter syndrome. Like it's just a part of our lives for some reason. But I think that's part of being an artist too. It's where it's like you hate the thing, you hate the thing, and you're creating the thing, and then you like it for maybe a minute, and then you want to walk away from it and never see it again. But it was, yeah. I mean, I should be more confident about that experience because it was really great, and I learned a lot about working with teams and working like in the lighting department as opposed to like just being a lighting designer. Even you're always on a team, right? Theater or art, like you're typically working in a team when it comes to lighting design. But this was like a very structured, like go to the office every day and sit at a desk and draft and work with the other designers and the other assistants. And that's part of something that I definitely realized isn't taught at all. And by the end of the experience, I realized why it's not taught, because it's very difficult to learn something that is so rooted in experience without experiencing it. Which of course sounds obvious when you are reflecting back on it, but like I've been like trying to like come up with like a, because I really want to be a professor one day, and I have taught, but I coming up with a way to teach what I've just gone through for the past 9 months at these three large theatrical institutions. So yeah,
Yeah, it's
it's.
funny. I think about that a lot too, because I got that experience at my internship at Seattle Rep. And it's weird because so Anthony and I, for some background, met at the theater school as undergrads. We were in the same graduating class. And he hated me for the first year that he was there, but he'll never admit it.
I did not hate you, just to be clear.
And it's fine, we're friends now. And you learn a lot of really great fundamental things at the theater school. You learn to be a good, you learn the key things that you need, which is, how to do research, how to articulate your thoughts, how to draw the basics of a plot, the basics of rendering, and you get to find your artistic voice, or at least the beginning of it. But it's a little difficult because they do a really great job in preparing you for working at a regional theater level. And when you're graduating from undergrad, you're not going to start working at regional theater level. Like
Oh,
maybe,
that's so true. Yeah.
yeah.
In a way, you're overprepared for where
Yeah,
you are.
exactly. Yeah. So it was really weird. And one thing that I really did love about the program is the moment that you're accepted, you're treated as a professional. So everything is like it's a critique and it's not criticism. You learn that very quickly that there is a key difference between those two things. And to really quickly kind of the phrase is kill your babies, and that's really intense, but like, every idea that you have is like a little version of yourself, and you learn very quickly not to get too attached and to just like slash them or just move on from them really quickly. Which is incredibly valuable, 'cause that's what's been really interesting too in working professionally is that like I feel like there are a lot of weird egos and there's no time for that. Most often, because you just need to finish.
You absolutely need to work so quickly in this industry that, like, and that's another thing. You got to experience it. You can't be taught that, because you can hear the word quick and faster, but if you're just sitting in the classroom, what context is that? I mean, like, half the dance pieces I saw teched, new works, were done in an hour and a half. Like, and then you ran in front of press.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So I was so blown away. Like, it was not 2 weeks in the room, to be clear. you had to like throw together those cues very quickly
Yeah.
and book them at the same time with the SM. They are incredible people.
Yeah.
It's true because like what you were saying about, I don't know, ideas, and it's like this thing where like you're developing ideas in school, and they're for yourself, they're remarkable, right? Like in that moment of infancy when the idea is first hatched and you want to like create a work or a piece of art, you're so excited about it. And making that energy last throughout the creation of the project was something that like I took from coming out of, I went right from undergrad right into grad school for some reason. But yeah, like which was actually great because in grad school you had a little more time to just work on your own projects. But it's definitely something I was thinking about, even like working the last 9 months, is a lot of what's done in the dance world and opera world is remounting ideas that were developed 60 years ago. So it's fascinating to see the precision and the craft that goes into that, because you hear that and you're thinking, why are we doing old ideas again? But that's not necessarily the experience for the viewer in the room. That could be their first time seeing the thing, and it's kind of our jobs when we're in that field to maintain the energy that had been imbued into those projects in the very beginning. So yeah, it's one of the things I was really thinking about as I've gone through that whole process with the Hemsley internship specifically.
Going back to like how to teach that though, because
Yeah.
I felt very prepared when I graduated from undergrad, and I applied for the internship at Seattle Rep, which is now an apprenticeship, which is really cool.
Right.
And it was a really eye-opening experience for a lot of reasons, but I definitely met, you know, my intern supervisors. I definitely consider them my mentors. But I was not prepared for what I learned there, if that makes sense, because it's working really quickly, really fast, and being able to then quickly work with a union crew, because it's a union house, so working with, you know, crew heads, not being able to touch anything and do things yourself, like really having to
Yeah.
focus on the soft skills, which is just articulating and writing things clearly so that if for whatever reason you can leave your notes with someone and everything can still be done.
Yeah, entirely. That's working specifically. I learned so much at the opera in San Francisco. The lighting director there, Justin Partier, is amazing. Basically, one of the first things I realized working there was that I had come in like all prepped, right? I had my iPad, I had like the Apple Pencil, and I was going to be like taking all the notes. And he handed me a like little notebook of paper and a pencil and was like, "Yeah, this is all you're actually going to need for the next 4 months." And he was right, because you basically are not doing to-do lists. You're not doing like work notes for the Thursday morning call. You're doing What you're writing down are the decisions you made at Focus in the moment. Because, like, what you need to change the documentation in the moment while you have the electrician, like, you need to, like, be on top of all that. So it was fascinating because you're writing down what you just did, not what you have to do. So that in 10 years, when it's redone at the Met or wherever, that there is documentation on why that channel is this number and so forth. Yeah, a crash course for sure.
And then also having to you're documenting what you've done and then writing down notes that the designer might want to change for your specific run, and then also documenting why you're doing those things.
Yeah, it's and how do you teach that? Yeah, send your students out as assistants. But there's too many of us anyways, so I
Yeah.
don't so don't do that because I want to assist people too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. I taught a course at Northwestern last year in the undergrads I taught, and I thought I was going to be like such a hard ass coming from the conservatory program. I was not. I was a complete pushover because all I wanted to see these kids do was develop ideas. And I did not ever want to be the person telling them an idea wouldn't work,
Yeah.
even if I knew that there was the potential that it might, and maybe if there was like a push, you know. So like there's a balancing act I have to learn when it comes to that. But maybe there's not. Maybe that's just who I am when I'm in the room with students, just telling them to push their ideas.
I think it depends, and I think our advisor in undergrad did a really good job of finding that line too, because it is hard because you don't want to stunt the growth of an artist, but you also want to show them their full potential and show them that they're thinking inside of this box, but that they can really think outside of it. Yeah.
It's true. And like even it's like letting them know they are an artist, right? Because that's one of the toughest lessons I've learned is yeah, I'm not like a lighting technician. I'm not a lighting designer. I'm an artist.
Yeah.
That's what I identify as. And I think for me that works in my precious balance of confidence, skill, and accomplishment, right?
Yeah.
Like I can see myself as that. But it's with students and just trying to nurture and like, yeah, the whole responsibility thing does push into it though sometimes, where you have to, you know, no, you had to actually bring work today, because art isn't this nondescript thing out there in the air. Art is being an artist is productivity, and you need to be able to bring that to respond to your own work. And you know, I can't judge a Chinese opera after seeing one. I need to see so many of them, and then I'll have a framework to judge it. So it was the same thing with pushing them for their art. Thank you, Design Theory, Marcus Doshi.
So you talk about considering yourself an artist. Do you know if there was ever a specific moment where like it all clicked, or like if there was one project or experience where you were like, whoa, I'm an artist.
I think it definitely comes from my experiences with my peers throughout the last 7 or so years. I mean, certainly you were a part of that, and the people that I went through grad school with, for sure. It's recognizing the design interplay and the ideas that happen while in the room, like not in the tech room, not in the we're sitting at the board. I'm talking more about like the phase of development where you're coming up with how to adapt a script or how to create a performance or a happening. Those types of things kind of push me to realize that the boundaries, I guess, that you were just mentioning that existed in my mind, you know, what is a performance? Is it, does it have to be in a theater? Like I guess if there's a specific project, it would probably be something very academic and you know, very, very educational from grad school that pushed me into that. But like exploring and the people that I found inspirational really helped me kind of, you know, form who I am as an artist. It's a long way of saying that I think it's through experience with your peers and the people you're working with that you develop yourself and your identity.
What's your process like as an artist, either as a lighting designer or however?
Yeah, I mean, tackling, you know, the initial idea put forth from the team or from the director, research, research, research. I want to know everything about where the project came from. If it's a script, I want to read about the playwright. I mean, these are the ground rules that everybody seems to follow, but I like to map all these things out literally in spreadsheets, and have that information because I don't remember anything. So I need to have all of the information that is behind a project or an idea in front of me while I work. At the tech table, I literally have my design concept printed out underneath my magic sheet because I just want that roadmap for myself, to keep myself honest. I mean, if you're doing a project that, doesn't literally have anything to do with lighting, you still want to remain dramaturgically in line with your initial ideas, those ideas that came in that infancy. And that can be tough because you start compositionally responding as well in the room to how it looks, which you also have to do. So it's about thinking about, for me, the information that is guiding your initial ideas, you want to keep it present throughout. And then I love to render. Something that I have actually kept doing outside of school, which everybody tells you won't happen, but I have enjoyed doing it in Photoshop, and I'm still playing with watercolor and gouache somehow. I really miss working with markers, and they're ironically faster, but I don't find the level of control in them that I have with watercolors.
That's funny. I feel the opposite, but that's just how everyone works with different mediums, so.
Yeah, it's like watercolors. I guess the reason I like them is because I can make a thing on the page and not like it, and then just put more water on the page and kind of like literally just wipe it away so very specifically. Whereas I feel so committed to a marker mark, right? Like I use Tom Toms for a long time because they're cheap versions of Copics, and I really enjoyed using them, but they like I would throw away so many pieces of paper because I made the wrong mark.
Oh, that's
But I do
funny.
find like the it's a good way of communicating an idea to a director and to a team still for me.
That's funny. I remember in figure drawing, I don't know if you were in my class that year, but one year in figure drawing, our professor told us the story of how when they were in school, they finally got into, I've been thinking about the story a lot actually, so that's why I bring it up. They got onto this really amazing and intense drawing class with like a really intense professor or drawing instructor. And she was so excited to get in the class and she was excelling and the professor loved her and was like, oh, you're such a great artist, blah, blah, blah. And one day she really impressed the drawing instructor and was like, the drawing instructor came up to her and was like, that is the most beautiful knee I've ever seen rendered and drawn. It's gorgeous. And she was so proud. And in that moment, just added like one more hatch or one more line. And her drawing instructor came up and was like, what have you done? You've ruined it. You've ruined it. So.
That is the perfect like nutshell of my process right there.
No, it's a good lesson though, because it's a good lesson of when to know when to stop doing work.
Yeah, and it's I mean constantly I finish writing a cue and then like grab three of the channels and turn everything else off. And realized like, oh, I just needed to turn things off. Which really, circling back, sorry, I'm gonna do this, but I'm really just all over the place. But like the moment I realized I think that I was an artist was the moment I embraced essentialism And the fact that like I was way overusing lights, specifically in designs, and you typically don't need them all.
Yeah, I learned that too. One time I drew a plot in college, and I took it to our advisor to look over it, and she was like, "There's not a lot going on here." And I was like, "I know, but I think I'm gonna use all of these lights. Like, they're gonna be turned on. Every single one at some point, like, will be used." And then at the end of tech or whatever, she came up to me and was like, "All right, cool. Like, yeah, like, you have a purpose for every light, and you didn't do too much, and it worked." And I was like, "Yay, it's a little win."
It's a big win.
Yeah.
It's a big moment to know that the ideas you brought forth were not arbitrary.
Yeah.
They were actually integral to the concept you had put forth in the beginning, and that's great.
Yeah, it's a hard line to toe though, and I constantly have a battle with myself too of like what is essential and what can go, you know. Is it a quality of life thing? Like if I add these, you know, 20 additional MAC quantum washes, are they really going to make the show that much better, or will they just look cool?
And is looking cool part of the idea?
Yeah.
Because there is a level if it's part of the design that you need that spectacle, then that's okay. But it just needs to have a purpose. And if the purpose is that it looks cool, that's fine. But you better have actually done the work.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it won't look cool.
Yeah.
Because aesthetic is good design if it's designed.
Yes. Crazy.
Just look to the 10 principles, Dithyrambs.
Do you want to share those with everyone?
Oh wow, you want me to read off the principles?
You don't
Hold on.
have to.
Dithyrambs, he's an industrial designer that I hope you've heard of. But
I have
he
not.
oh well there's 10 principles that I'll read that I find myself are very helpful in terms of keeping myself honest throughout the process. Good design is innovative. Good design makes a product useful. Good design is aesthetic. Good design makes a product understandable. Good design is unobtrusive. Good design is honest. Good design is long-lasting. Good design is thorough down to the last detail. Good design is environmentally friendly, and good design is as little design as possible.
Whoa. I love that you have the printed and just hanging on your wall. That's good design.
That's true. Well, to be honest, my wife has them printed on the wall, but I have them bookmarked on that iPad though. But see, this piece of paper was faster. It was there. So, paper and a pencil every time, folks.
Seriously, no, and don't use pen. I'm a bad example because I use pen all the time, but you gotta use pencil. That's
They
what.
make whiteout dispensers. This is something I also learned at the opera. It's like a little piece of white tape that, like, once you apply it, it just, I know everybody that's out there that's like an office supply person is like, yeah, of course they do. But I didn't know that. And this was like, see, one of the things I learned in 1 month at
Yeah.
San Francisco Opera that I didn't learn in 3 years of grad school.
Yeah, everyone go work at SF Opera so you can learn about office supplies. I remember one day during my internship, my designer, LB, who's also one of my lighting dads, he was a designer and he ran up on stage during like a 10-minute break to start giving notes. And so I grabbed my plot and I followed him and everything, but I grabbed what was nearest and it was a pen. And he stopped midway through his notes and he goes, and remind me to tell you, or it was something like, remind me to remind you not to write on a plot with pen again, or something like that. Because there's a very strict red pencil rule that you have to use.
Oh, yeah.
To write on the plot with.
And, interesting.
Yeah. And so it was really funny because we were going. And he was just messing with me, of course, so. But he was also very serious, so. I was like, okay, I'm so sorry. Don't fire me. My internship's almost over anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, God. It's that, like, odd, like, see, there's that confidence thing again with like, mentors and bosses now. But it also it's odd to, like, see the different levels of importance on a piece of paperwork at different institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some places the plot is like, oh, we didn't need that pass hang. And other places it's the Bible. Every note is on it, every correction. And it's fascinating to track that.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the biggest challenges of the internship I went through were those three amazing companies all operate completely different.
Yeah.
And you have to go through all three jobs that people want in this industry in the span of 8 months and learn all three of those systems. And that's definitely something that I'm really thankful to have now, because I'm one of the small collection of people that can fill in.
Yeah. So, which is,
and if it amazing. Wasn't for this pandemic, I would have been on stage last week.
Yeah.
At the ballet, but yeah, here we are.
Yeah. It's hard not to dwell on those things too, because I've definitely had a few shows that were like, I had a show that was canceled mid-load-in, like literally my plot had finished hanging, my programmer and I were going through, like, we're just flashing through the rig, and all of a sudden it was like, that's it, thank you so much, please take everything down and we'll see you later. And I was like, that's crazy. So it's hard not to dwell on those things right now though, because I also think that, like, we talked about just, like, having to go, and I just need to be productive, and I need something to show that I've been productive, because I'm a monster, I guess. I don't know. but it's been hard not to, like, work on something and have it be, like, finished, if that makes any sense. Like,
I do kind of know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
I started Breath of the Wild on Nintendo Switch and have to finish it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a bit different. Not quite as productive, but
no, yeah. I mean, yeah, I've been learning Cinema 4D and modeling things, and being able to step away and be like, it's finished now, has been really difficult. So, but
yeah,
because I want to constantly tweak it, but then there's also a part of me that's just like, it's the knee thing. Like, I just hear that story in my head and I'm like, stop, just stop it. Like, if you add one more thing, it'll ruin it.
Yeah. See, that's tough for me, because the only, like, professional thing I'm currently working on is a resource library for a lighting firm, and basically those are never done. Like, you have to keep adding things. So,
yeah.
Like, I just keep working on it, which is a little OCD, but at one day it's going to be done.
Right. But will it ever? Because it's the same thing with a show. Like, you're never done designing a show.
It's not. It's a developing thing, right?
Yeah.
That keeps expanding.
Yeah.
It's keeping that spark, though, right? Like, even in as something as like mundane as paperwork, like, it's keeping that spark of creativity that drives it forward. That is always the goal.
Yeah. And it's always weird, because even after, I feel like when I used to do a lot of theater shows, it was like every time a show closes and goes away, like, you're still thinking about what could have been better. And I still think about that now that I do more events, but it's a little different. It's a little like, oh, I could have been more efficient, or maybe I should have swapped that fixture out, or, you know,
yeah,
things like that. And more so, whereas with theater, I feel like it's more about, like, timing and, like, maybe that fade could have been faster, or the crossfade didn't actually work there, or you
It could
know.
have came on this line, which would have made it mean that much more in the context of so and so. And like, yeah,
Yeah.
it's there's definitely like a thing where I try. I mean, speaking strictly as a like lighting designer in theater, where I try to keep the arc of the lighting honest to the arc of the dramaturgy and the plot. And typically I race through tech as quickly as I can because one, directors want it done, and two, production managers want it done. But it allows me a chance to respond to what I've done before we open, which is ultimately the goal. I want to be able to respond to what I've done. It's same with watercolor. Like, I want to make the mark and then look at it, know that it's shit, and change it. Like, I do not want to see that psych just bouncing from color to color to color every
Yeah.
scene. Like,
That's
unless
so
it's
hard.
like,
Wow. I haven't thought about like lighting a psych in a very long
yeah.
time. Well, yes and no, but for different purposes. Like, yeah.
Like, if it's the same color until that one moment, it will mean that much more in that one moment, possibly. So it's hard to talk about lighting because, like, in terms of like what works and what doesn't, because it's typically rooted in the script or the source material. And when you're talking about it in things like this in the classroom, it might not be rooted in a script or source material. So like, it's people like to generalize. Young students like to generalize sometimes. I like to generalize. But the honest truth of it is that the details are where the truth lies. So you really have to like parse out every single moment.
Yeah. Lighting's also really hard to talk about because it's intangible and it's so perception based, but that's also why I love it because, like, our definitions of blue are probably different because of the way we've learned about the color, the way we've perceived the color, and all those fun things. But I think that to me is what makes it all kind of worth it, is that you can put on the same show for hundreds, thousands, millions of people, and everyone is perceiving it just slightly different based on experience and color and just prior knowledge.
And vision. People see color differently.
Yeah.
People see contrast differently. People see contrast a lot differently.
Yeah.
People will look at a stage and say it's dark, and some will say it's extremely bright.
Yeah.
It's why I find that talking about the story is typically a lot more effective for me than talking about the lighting in with a team, because if the team trusts you as a storyteller, the lighting will be fine in the room. It'll be more than fine. But if they can engage you as a person and as a storyteller and as an artist in that sense, they will trust your sensibilities when it comes to what lights are turned on and what colors are used.
Yeah.
9 times out of 10. And I have found that to be true.
Yeah. What would you say some of your biggest inspirations or influences are?
Dieter Rams, those 10 principles that I mentioned. I enjoyed the works of Cunningham, in the dance world. John Cage, the non-discriminate music, or not discriminate, indeterminate music, music, if you want to call it that. But basically the idea of indeterminacy, where you don't particularly know what's going to happen. We've just been talking about scripts, but works that are rooted in something coincidentally happening, I'm really drawn to. It's something that I've been kind of exploring over the last year, particularly in the dance world, which there's the super traditional, the Balanchines, but there's also the more, I'm air quoting, modern dance. I've also really enjoyed, I feel like every lighting designer says this, but and I'll probably butcher the pronunciation, but Ólafur Eliasson and his installations. And light installations in general were one of the greatest part of the Hemsley internship because I was in San Francisco and New York City. And in the rare like free time that I did have, I would had access to some great museums. Obviously the MoMA, but like Pace in New York, where I saw Robert Irwin's Unlit, which was basically an installation of fluorescent tubes that he was remounting with, but not lit this time. But the absolute attention to how they were displayed, and they were just perfectly in harmony with each other, and it was really, it was an inspirational exhibit. And Pace, by the way, is free and an amazing place to go see art once we're in a world that we can do that again. In terms of theater, I really, really enjoy Looking Glass in Chicago. They have a balance of performance, spectacle, and story that I find pretty unparalleled. And a Chicago theater in general is still my favorite place to
Top
work.
notch, honestly.
And like, don't get me wrong, I love dance, and I love, it's funny because where I work and what I necessarily want to watch as an artist is not necessarily the same thing. I responded to the dance world as an artist much more strongly than the opera, but I enjoyed working at the opera all that much more, as a designer. So it's we change depending on who we're working for and what we're working with and how we're perceiving it, right? But those are some of my inspirations. And I have to, of course, Robert Wilson in the opera world is pretty unparalleled. Philip Glass, that's like, Philip Glass is, I listen to Philip Glass every day. Like, I really respond well to that because it's essential, every note to the composition.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Have you watched Olafur Eliasson's episode of Abstract on Netflix?
Have I? Yeah, I
Yeah.
have.
I watched it on my flight to Frankfurt last year and I cried. I didn't know what to do. Like, I wanted to
Yeah.
like stand up and like run up and down the aisles and be like, did no one else just like feel that? And of course they didn't because I was watching it on my iPad, but it was amazing. I really love him and James Turrell. Him and James Turrell, I think, are my favorite lighting artists.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Ólafur Eliasson's The Weather Project, which is this project in where was that? Tate,
It
I
was at
think.
Tate, London, yeah.
That was pretty foundational in terms of like experiences within grad school that I came upon and like taught myself about. That was pretty integral to my education.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish Tate is one of the museums that's on my bucket list. I have a bucket list of museums. And it's definitely up there. They do some really amazing things. And I saw a James Turrell piece. I like to say I experienced it. It's a little pretentious, but I feel like there are some pieces that you see, some that you perceive, and some that you experience.
Yeah, of course.
And I experienced, I think his most accessible and famous one, which is the room that is just lit completely evenly, and then you have slow fades between contrasting colors. I don't remember the name of it, but I remember being in the room at LACMA a few years ago, and just like crying.
Yeah.
Because it was ex so experiential and emotional in a really interesting way. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, see, like, and that's like one of those things where like somebody has to turn those lights on every day, and somebody has to like prep that room every day. And it doesn't make it less of an idea for the people experiencing it every day. So I'm still fascinated by this concept of like art throughout time and when it does or doesn't lose its value. Sorry, that just made me think of that. Like you look at like even in theater, where this is a hot topic, right? Like, why are we doing this show in this day? But like occasionally there is a work that comes along that is a remount of a 50-year-old book or something that is saying a lot about what we're going through today. And I find those really important to maintain, as well, of course, as creating new works, which are, I think, personally should be 96% of what we're doing. But I do find it's not just a black and white. It's not it's like there is value in the experience depending on the viewer and the moment in time in when they see the thing. So it's always fascinating to me, especially in the theatrical world where there is such an emphasis put on why are we doing this show today? And you have to balance ticket sales, which is seemingly only going to be that much more important moving forward in this
Right, which is funny
time.
because sometimes it feels like theater companies only do certain shows because they know it'll be their big box office seller, you know,
Oh,
because
yeah, of
that
course.
play has been around for so long. So, like, for example, sometimes, well, that's a bad example, never mind. I was going to use Hedda Gabler as an example because it's such an
Gotcha.
established play, and it's one of my favorite plays, to be honest with you. It's such an established show, and everyone knows Ibsen, right? That's an Ibsen play.
Right.
And every time they hear Henrik Ibsen, they're like, oh, he's amazing. Like, because he's such a part of the canon. So they know that they're going to get ticket sales regardless. But also, the show has a lot of really great messages towards about feminism and what it means to be a woman in that day and age and how that's still relevant to a lot of today's points. So it feels like it can definitely hit double duty. So that's why I think it's a bad example of what we were just discussing, but yeah.
But I mean, it's one of those examples that carries the weight of, and it's actually still happening. It's still the fact that it still resonates is sad, and in a way, and all that much more important. I like really, really enjoy drinking coffee, and I have not been drinking coffee. Through
What?
this, like, yeah, I had a cup today because I had to like do this, so I had to be present of mind. But like, yeah, like I have not been drinking coffee, and I don't know if it's one of those rare moments of like self-care where I was like, wait, let's take this opportunity where I'm not waking up at 5 in the morning to like. But it might also be like how anxious this whole thing makes me sometimes, so I'm just like, don't drink coffee.
That's fair.
But I have found rooibos tea, which is not caffeinated and amazing, with a little lemon. And the essentialist that I am, that's what I was drinking like in April. And now that we're in May, I'm down to water and lemon, hot water, and no tea. So I think like next month I'll just be eating a lemon.
The morning lemon. And that's it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
You're the second person who I know that has stopped drinking coffee during all of this. Why
Yeah.
would you do that?
I mean, for me, it
Oh,
honestly is rooted in like, let's not trigger some anxiety
yeah,
here.
that's fair. Yeah.
But like, oh, why would I do that?
No, it's a form of
I
self-care. I get it. I totally get it.
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's interesting too because, like, I saw this thing. Basically, so working in New York City and San Francisco, I can tell you, like, that San Francisco has the best coffee
That's not true. I'm
in the
sorry.
world.
I'm sorry.
In
That's
the
not true.
world.
It's not
In the
true.
world.
I lived in
Now,
Seattle, and it's not true.
when I say the world, I guess I'm talking about my world, which I've never been to Seattle, so I can't. have this debate with you. But I have had coffee in at least 5 shops in San Francisco, and I can tell you that in my world, they have the best coffee. And I can tell you without a doubt that New York City has the worst selection of coffee, full stop. And see, people are like, well, we're never hiring this guy again.
but hope you like working in New York.
The one place I found good coffee in New York City was Blue Bottle, which had just opened there and had come from San Francisco.
Yeah, that's a San Francisco company. That's funny.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. The best coffee in New York is at Dunkin' Donuts. And yeah, stand behind that.
There was no Dunkin' Donuts like anywhere near where I was working. And so that's when the tea transition started while I was working at New York City Ballet. Because I went to Earl Grey because that's what I can get at Starbucks. I mean, there's a cost plateau here that I'm not willing to break, you know. And like, I'm sure there is amazing coffee in New York that is like $15 a glass, but I wasn't willing to pay that.
Yeah, it is very pricey. It's pretty pricey in Seattle too, but I feel like that's if only you're getting like lattes and fancy drinks. But as someone who just drinks Americanos, it's usually like $3.
Yeah. But as a plus, wait, because I love New York, and that's, you know, the last place I called home before this. And I do have to say they have the best pizza in the world. And that's coming from somebody that lived in Chicago for 7 years. So, yeah.
It's fine. Everyone's entitled to their wrong opinions, but it's okay. I know.
I also found amazing diners, best Italian food. So New York does have its pluses.
Like, I get it. I get that deep dish is a meal. Like, a slice of deep dish is, that's it. You're eating one slice and that's it. And you can't do that all the time. You can't eat deep dish every week. And it's terrible drunk food. I get it. But it's better than New York pizza. And I'm sorry.
I don't know how you could come to that conclusion in any logical way.
Because so I lived there chart for on this. So much of my life.
Yeah, okay, fine.
The real hot topic debate as a Chicagoan is who has the best deep dish pizza.
Oh, I have to go Luminati's. I do. Yeah. Pequod's is up there.
Yeah.
They're still open, right?
Yeah.
Because they only have one location, Pequod's.
They have two, I think.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay, there's a second location, but I'll give them close second. But yeah. I gotta go Luminati's. Yeah.
I think Luminati's only because it's more accessible, and that's why it gets the vote over Pequod's for me.
Yeah, that's true. Every time I went to Pequod's, there was a line.
Yeah, and it's always like 2 hours.
And it's also a bar. So it's like you also have to deal with the noise level.
Yeah. Because I just went there recently, because when my boyfriend and I were in Chicago, I took him to Pequod's because I was like, you will eat deep dish and you will like it. and I think they opened a new building next door that's now a bar. So I think it's like a split kind of.
Because there was an Italian place there that closed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I do like Luminati's more, too. I think it's my favorite. Although I did go to Giordano's whenever I was with my family last. We went to Giordano's one night, and it was really good.
Chicago's just a cool town. I miss it. I miss it. I miss Chicago. I was there for a week right before everything started shutting down. Like, right before. And it is the perfect balance of city and accessibility and for me, I'm speaking, like that, I mean, you can just go to the Art Museum on a Saturday and it won't be too crowded. It'll be like major city crowded, but it won't be like you have to wait at a door.
Yeah. Every time I went there, every time I go, because I try to go to the Art Institute at least once every time I'm home. It's definitely one of my favorite museums, and it's really cool.
Yeah.
But it's never too busy. Yeah.
It's actually because you got me a membership, right? The first time I
Oh
had it.
yeah, I got you and
Yeah.
Sydney a
So,
membership, yeah.
yeah, we kept that membership and expanded it for 3 more years, 2 more years.
Yeah.
And if you are the next level up, you can go to the cafe in there for free. And like, I would work in there. I would just go downtown and work in that cafe, and
Cool.
you could get free coffee.
Oh, whoa, that's
Yeah.
a really
So,
good perk.
this podcast was brought to you by this advertisement for the Art Institute.
Art Institute of Chicago, please sponsor us.
It's a nice, like, safe place.
Yeah, it's the best. It really is.
Other than the brown line.
I love the Brown Line. I miss the Brown Line so much. I miss living off
I
the Brown
know.
Line. I miss Southport. Ugh.
Oh, and it took me a while, but I came around to the New York transit system and do love it as well.
Really?
Yeah, they definitely have, in my opinion, San Francisco beat on that front. Yeah. The Q line, all
Yeah.
about it. It's yellow. I don't know how people refer to it yet, but I've been there long enough to like know that my train comes and it's yellow and it is also the Q. I can also take the N and the R, W, I think it was, but those will take longer. Not the N necessarily, but yeah. I know, this is fascinating.
I love the CTA, and I don't think anything is better than the CTA.
Oh no, the CTA is by far the best transit system of any city that I have experienced.
Yeah, that's what I think too. It doesn't really exist here in LA. It does, but it doesn't. In Seattle, it's kind of the same thing. It's there. You definitely need to master it a little bit though, more in Seattle. Yeah. Also, Seattle's a pretty small city, so you can actually walk most of it.
That's, San Francisco is the same. I walk to work every day. It was like a 45-minute walk, and it was like walking across a good portion of the city. Like an extra 40 minutes, you really can walk. Like 2 hours, you can walk basically from downtown out to the ocean.
That's cool.
It is cool. I really dug San Francisco. Not in the moment, but upon reflection, they have a lot of challenges, of course, that everybody like sees in the press and things, but like they have amazing food, they have amazing dive bars, like the best dive bars I've ever been to, and the deals can be found. Luckily, my lighting director that I worked for there was a originally from there and knew all the places to go. But yeah, food truck days, and yeah, it's such a cool town with probably the best weather of any town I've been in.
I went to visit a friend who lived in San Fran, for a few days, and it was really cool, and I really liked it because it's a very Veda city. It's very artsy. There's like enough local cool kind of punky things that you can do and kind of get yourself into just enough trouble with. And but the wealth displacement is just huge. So
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
yeah.
It's a challenge. There are times where you do have to really be careful about where you step into.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's shocking to see. It's shocking to see the lines of one city block to the next, and that it has progressed to that point. But I feel like I'm less shocked about it, reflecting on it, knowing how little the people in charge seem to know about anything. Like in regards to the pandemic, now I'm like, oh, like maybe there just isn't anybody that fixes these things. Like what? But yeah, the level of economic disparity there is huge. I don't know in what world I could ever financially live there, like actually for a long period of time. But I'm glad that some people can do it, because the heart of the city is really beautiful. My family business that I kind of grew up working in is an audio production company, live events, theaters, installation, that sort of thing, that my dad and my mom built from the ground up. And I'm really fortunate to have had that growing up, because one, it got me into the arts in a kind of backdoor way. where I just started doing lighting and realizing that like I liked the teamwork with theatrical teams, and I liked that collaboration of ideas. But two, like doing sound pays the bills. Because nobody wants to do it. Nobody wants to. That's not true. People want to be the audio engineer at a concert and a festival and a theater, and it's great. It's lovely. When you see a person walking towards you at the soundboard, you hate your life more than like anybody. And like I have a lot of gray hair, and I call it my sound career. And like it's because it is so stressful and things go wrong and people just like, and like what is with like people walk up to a microphone, right? Like this delicate instrument. The first thing they do 105% of the time is hit it. They hit the mic, okay? And like I don't know why, because I'm like this really like calm and chill and monotone and kind of like whatever lighting designer in the room. But when I am a sound engineer, I am Mark Ruffalo, and I am always angry. And people would walk up and be like, "Oh, you can't hear the bass over there," or "All you can hear is the bass over there." I'm like, half the events I was working were free. I was like, "You just wandered in here. Like, who are you?" And like, go ask for your money back. There was no money to get back because they didn't pay to go. And like, it's just like everybody is a critic, but everybody is a professional sound engineer. You know how they say everybody's an expert now, like because of the internet and everybody thinks they're a doctor? That hit the sound industry 50 years ago. Everybody in the room knows more than you. And I'm like, well, it's because you're near the wall and it's reflecting and bass is like, you know, enveloping and blah, blah, blah. And they're just like, yeah, but it's too loud. And I'm like, yeah, I understand that. Go stand over there, dude. I don't know what to tell you because like it's just it's cool. I really enjoy I do enjoy mixing. I'm not I wouldn't call myself a sound designer per se. I think that's a whole field and craft that I am not versed in, and I am fascinated by the choices they make. I really am. I think it's cool things that they make happen in theaters. But when it comes to like making a band sound like a thing, that's I love that. It's my jam and I like doing it a lot. Celtic music specifically, but you know, all music. And I still do it. It still helps pay the bills. And it's a source of pride because I'm family business and my dad's gonna work every day of his life. He loves doing it. You know, he in a way, he's never gone to work because it's for him, it's about the people, and that's why I love lighting, because it's about the people on the teams that I'm working with. But I do enjoy a good mix. I do enjoy a good audio mix, and I enjoy being the one responsible for it, even if nobody in the room likes it. So yeah.
Do you think your experience with mixing shows has influenced you as a lighting designer at all?
Yeah, in the sense that more on a technical side, but like to engage an artist on stage that's standing 200 feet in front of you, there are certain responsibilities. I hate that word. That you have to, you have to, you should, you should is also to. You can. There are certain responsibilities that you may choose to take upon yourself, like hearing the person talking, or seeing the person talking. So there, and that's just part of the design, right? But like, yeah, I don't know. My brain works in a different way when it comes to sound, and I don't know why, because it's potentially really cathartic thing, and maybe it's something I want to explore more as an artist, sound, that you can all close your eyes and experience the same thing at varying levels because everybody hears at different levels, just like they see at different levels. I'll talk myself in circles on this one because I have a lot of feelings about being a sound engineer. Musicians, y'all, they're a lot. They're a whole lot. I've worked with some really talented and great musicians though. So it's neat to experience that side of it and see their brains work
Yeah.
in ways that I'm sure some people see my brain work and be like, "What the fuck, man?"
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I've only worked with one artist, one music artist, but she kind of transcends like the title of just music artist. She's an artist. And it was crazy. It was really cool. I was like, I will never achieve a form of artistry as this. And here we are.
Yeah, here we are though. You know what? The thing about it that hasn't formed me as a lighting designer is when I'm lighting concerts, of course, in musicals because there's music and everything. But I, unless there's not, but I do think that it hasn't being an audio engineer really helped me explore timing because I've listened to so much live music. And the collaboration happening between the percussions and the rhythm help you determine like, hey, that's a cue. That is a cue right there, very clear. And it may be clear to you in a literal sense of where that cue is, and it may sound right to the audience and look right to the audience, but when you're trying to convey that moment to somebody to mark in a book, it helps if you know what you're talking about musically, and that I don't know. So, and that's definitely something I've learned is that like there's so many sides to music. There's like knowing it classically. There's knowing how to read music. There's knowing how to write music, perform music, and there's knowing how to tailor music and mix music. I have a very small little piece of that pie.
Do you know how to read sheet music?
If you give me no, I'll say my answer is no, but if you give me a piano and a piece of music to play, I can play it really slowly and badly. I do know what the notes are, I can see them, but my muscles can't play at speed because I just don't do it anymore.
But you can like hear it or
I
interpret it.
can look at it and know what it sounds like.
Whoa,
Which
yeah.
is important for it's not necessary, but it helps a lot with being an assistant in opera. Because then you can help your designer or your stage manager know where to put a cue. Just like a plug for stage managers in general. What I learned in the opera and dance world is that they are running that ship with so many more responsibilities than I knew were their responsibilities. And there was one point when I was working, and certain dance companies are different, right? They work in different ways and different methods. But there was one point when I looked at one of the assistants at one of the dance companies and said, "Wait, we haven't documented a single cue, and we just teched this whole piece, and I realized you're not doing it. Was I supposed to be doing that? You know, like, oh my God." And they were like, "No, the stage manager did that. They were listening and watching and did it." And I was like, "Wow, that's a lot of responsibility." Like, I had that moment of like, "Was that their job?" No, it's totally their job, and we want it to be their job because we don't have time for that to be our job. And they do so many other things in the other fields too. It's just, it was remarkable to me, particularly in dance, how much those stage managers are doing. They're basically the production manager as well at times, and they're touring. They're doing so much, and much more than I could ever commit to my brain. Yeah,
Amazing.
love them.
Yeah. Any advice or beliefs that you think people should know before we part?
Read those 10 Principles of Good Design by Dieter Rams. No, I think we're all in this moment, right, in the world right now, and think just, God, we have to be kind to each other. I've been so shocked at how politicized everything has been over the last 3 months. I mean, I've been absolutely shocked by it, and I'm like as in terms of what I know, liberal and progressive as they come, and there was something about the fact that this whole thing has been politicized that has really disheartened me. So I've had to remain positive, one, but two, it's a moment of like, holy shit, people, like get your shit together. Like, and I think that that, goes back to what I think coming out of this hopefully someday, is that art is this thing that is actually an extreme privilege to be able to practice. Because right now there are so many of us that we sure we can make art at home and we can do things over video chat and but there is this whole side of I think a lot of artists that is not fulfilled right now. And I can't wait for people to get out and explode onto that creative scene once it's safe. Because I think that we all need it. I think that there is a way of processing things for a lot of people that isn't happening right now because they have nothing to experience it through. And I think that we as artists, we as people, and we as collaborators and we as consumers can really enjoy some really great works in the next few years once it's happening.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Anthony.
Oh yeah, thanks for
Appreciate
having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. This has been really fruitful.
Cool. Yeah, I'm like super stoked.